Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
New Hampshire Center for Cognitive and Behavioral Therapies, providing outpatient, evidence-based, specialty behavioral health and substance use disorder services. NHCCBT.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. New Hampshire's Mount Washington is renowned for its beauty and for its peril, with the dubious distinction of having, quote, the world's worst weather. Yet hikers and climbers are attracted year-round to this challenging terrain. And so Mount Washington has been the scene of hundreds of accidents, mishaps, and even deaths, including one that's received perhaps more scrutiny and reflection than most, the 2015 winter hike that took the life of Kate Matrosova. Now a new book examines her story and the lessons everyone can glean about risk-taking and decision-making in a deceptively difficult environment. Let's hear from you, the Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. What have you noticed as you're out hiking in the White Mountains or in other parts of New Hampshire? Have you ever had a close call yourself while hiking in the state? Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have three guests in studio. Lieutenant James Neeland is here. He leads New Hampshire Fish and Game's 16-member advanced search and rescue team. And Lieutenant Neeland, it's really nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Corey Fitzgerald, co-owner of Northeast Mountaineering. He was guiding clients on the day that Kate Matrosova went missing. He was involved in the search and rescue team that found her the next day. And Corey, really good to have you. Thank you for making the trip down.
Absolutely.
And also with us, Ty Gagne. He's a certified wilderness first responder, a member of the Androscoggin Valley Search and Rescue Team and its board of directors. And he's author of the book that we will be looking at. It's called Where You'll Find Me, Risk, Decisions, and the Last Climb of Kate Matrosova. And Ty, thank you so much for being here too. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, Ty, what was it about this story that touched you in such a way that you were compelled to write a book about it? You're a business guy. You're not an author. A friend of yours said you didn't find this story, Ty. It found you.
Yeah, it wasn't really my intent to write a book when I first started talking with our members of the organization that I work for about the accident and how it relates to them from a decision-making and risk management standpoint. And what happened was that I was preparing this presentation for our annual conference around what we could learn from mountaineering accidents that would translate to managing risk in the public sector. And I was all set to go with that. And on the morning of February 16, 2015, I was up early. I live about an hour and 15 minutes south of the Presidential Range. And I was up early because the weather at the house was so bad. And I was getting ready to go out to start the portable generator because I fully expected we were going to lose power that day. And I saw the graphic come up on Channel 9 News, Missing Hiker, and was just completely drawn into the story of Kate going up the afternoon before, activating her emergency beacon, and that rescuers were unable to get to her Sunday night and were returning up there Monday morning.
Well, and we'll get into the details of the story throughout the hour, but let's just say up front that, you know, Kate Matrosova was not some of the hikers that, you know, Lieutenant Neeland rescues who go up, you know, Lincoln Lafayette in flip-flops and a tank top. I mean, she was very experienced.
She had some significant experience in peaks all over the world. Over a four-year period prior to the accident, she climbed four significant peaks, again, across the world.
Across the world, including she hadn't done Everest, had she? But she'd done some pretty challenging
summits. No, Everest was in her sights.
Right.
She had done Denali in Alaska, Aconcagua in South America, Kilimanjaro.
Wow.
Yeah, and Mount Rainier.
Well, and it just shows us too, Corey, and I'm sure you appreciate this, how unpredictable the White Mountains are. People don't appreciate that maybe. They don't look that tall. They're right there. They're in our backyard. You know, they look so pretty, but things can change in a heartbeat.
Yeah, I mean, we see it all the time up there. When we have our clients on the mountain, we see people in, you know, the jeans and the sweatshirts and all that kind of stuff. And most of the time they have a great time and get away with it. But it is the 8th deadliest mountain in the world, Mount Washington.
Really?
And yeah. I think a big part of it is the accessibility too. You know, we're so close to some major cities, and you can drive right to the base of it. You know, if it was a 20-mile hike in, I think we'd see a lot different people up there.
So part of it is, Corey, the fact that it's got this crazy, unpredictable weather. But part of it is it's just so close to, you know, major urban centers.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like a perfect storm. You know, you have so many people coming to this mountain, and it's got a lot of history. You know, it's very iconic for the weather. It's got an auto road, a cog. So it's very accessible. We have so many people coming in. And, you know, you put all those people in the world's worst weather, things happen.
Yeah, perfect storm. Not to have overused, but often a perfect way to encapsulate what you're saying. What do you think, Lieutenant Neyland?
I would agree. The accessibility to these mountains, I deal with Franconia Notch mostly in my district. And just it's an hour from Boston to get there, and they're there and hiking. And you can see the summits right from the road, and they just look like they're so close that they think they can do it in a half hour, an hour, and they don't check the guidebooks or the maps to realize it's going to take the better part of a day, yet they're leaving at 3 or 4 in the afternoon. So,
you've said some people, again, you know, start the hike in flip-flops and a T-shirt, and then something happens, and they call you and say, you know, can you just call me a helicopter, please? And you say, no, I can't do that.
No, the cost for that is ridiculous. You know, to have called everyone, the helicopter in for everyone that needs rescuing would just be a cost we couldn't absorb. You know, it would just not be fiscally responsible to do that when they really don't need it. They just need either a helping hand or wait the night or whatever to come out the next day in daylight. Or
one of the things that's so interesting about Ty's book is it does talk about, you know, decision-making, risk-taking, and how, you know, a lot of us, even the most seemingly well-prepared, don't make good decisions. I just wonder what you've seen, Lieutenant Neyland, in terms of people, you know, making a decision to go right or left when they should have just gone down.
Usually they will, I think for the most part, they do come down when they think they need to, but there's a certain few that continue on that have the drive to want to continue with what they started, that just think that deviating from what they initially started out to do is not something they wanted. They would consider their trip a failure, I guess, if they didn't finish the summit. So they keep on going, even though they should come down. But I think that's a small percentage, because if you sit at our trailheads, a lot of them probably shouldn't be there, and yet they somehow make it. So I think a lot of them are turning around when they need to. Yet a certain few keep going, and with cell phones as they are now, it's led to us getting calls in areas we never used to get calls. I've seen it in Franconia Notch. You know, there were probably people there that needed rescuing 20 years ago, but they had no ability to call for help, so they found their way out of their own predicament. Now it's just too easy to dial 911. And then they get me or someone else on the phone that then bears the responsibility to deal with it until they're successfully out of the woods.
How often do you say no when you get that 911 call? You sort of assess and you say, you know what, I think you can make it out. I'm not putting my team on your case today.
That happens a lot. I'm on the phone a lot throughout the summer months, especially and into the fall, with people that I talk to throughout the night. Just reassuring that you'll be fine. The sun will come up tomorrow morning and you can walk out in daylight, or I talk them out, or now with 911, I get coordinates of where they are so I can continually get updated as to the progress they're making, and then give them simple advice. Take a left at the next intersection, or you're looking for this brook drainage, follow that out. And so I'll sleep a lot of nights with my cell phone right on my chest so that when they call me every hour, I can get updated and then talk with them again and keep talking to them. So that happens a lot throughout the summer. So we don't go on every particular call. if we think we can help them out without having to go.
No, you must know those mountains like the back of your hand, all of you, to be able to, you know, assess on the phone where somebody is and to tell them where to make the right turn. What are your thoughts, Corey, on the use of technology in the outdoors, when it's helpful, when it isn't?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great backup. You know, I wouldn't rely on these new devices. It's a great thing to have in your pack. I know from my own personal experience, I bought a spot device probably 10 years ago or when it first came out. It's just like a personal locator. It updates your family. You know, you can press OK or I need help or whatever it is. And your family back home gets an email. They can track your progress. For me, I stopped using it because if for whatever reason it didn't send, my family would start to get nervous. You know, they'd be like, I haven't heard from you in 6 hours and you've been sending them every hour. What's wrong? You know, so it actually made my family more nervous that I had it because when it didn't send, it made them worry.
That's really interesting. Yeah. So it's supposed to make you feel better, but it ended up making them feel worse.
Yeah, pretty much. But I mean, it is nice. It's a nice tool to have in your pack if something actually, you know, dire went wrong. But I wouldn't, you know, overuse it or rely on it.
Ty, did Kate Matrasova have one of these locators? I think you said she had something like this in her
She did. She had a personal locator beacon, which is a little different from the Spot device that Corey's referring to. The Spot will provide a continuous update or you can text from it, whereas the personal locator beacon, once you activate it, it remains active the whole time, sends coordinates to satellites and really has to be shut off or shuts down because of battery loss.
And in addition to working on, you know, volunteer with the Androscoggin Valley Search and Rescue, author of this book, you professionally, Ty, assess risk and how people make decisions. So I wonder what you think about how people's use and access to technology is changing the way they assess risk in the White Mountains.
Yeah, I think it goes to the issue of moral hazard, which is our willingness to accept more risk because we have insurance behind us. And in this case, it would, you know, it could be a beacon or a satellite telephone or a cell phone. And, you know, that's a hard thing to quantify. I don't believe that technology causes us to assume more risk.
You don't think so? Because some people say it does.
I think we in general are hesitant to ask for help. And so I think that technology is often utilized. It's either too early or too late. And again, I don't think because I'm carrying a beacon, I'm going to push it. I think if I have a GPS, that gives me the sense that I can get myself back if I run into a whiteout or something like that. That might be the piece of technology that I think might cause a hiker or a climber to assume more risk than they normally would.
So it's not so much the communications technology, it's the GPS technology where you assume I can find my way out.
Right.
And in a whiteout, is GPS going to work properly?
Well, if the winds are low and you can see the screen and your goggles aren't frozen over, sure.
That's a lot of ifs.
It can be a very effective tool, but conditions are rarely optimal above treeline in the presidential range.
Well, and as Kate Matrasova found out, and we'll talk about that in just a second, I want to remind our listeners that you can join us today in the Exchange. We're looking at mountain rescues and a new book about one case that has received lots of scrutiny and generated lots of attention. One of our guests has written a book about it. It's called Where You'll Find Me. We're looking at this particular story, but what it says about all of us when it comes to how we assess risk, sometimes poorly, in a deceptively challenging environment. Again, the Exchange number for you to jump in is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. So, Corey, when Ty was saying people tend to use technology too early or too late, you were nodding. I wonder what you think.
Yeah, I just thought that was a really great point. You know, when you're in a situation like that, how do you judge, you know, if it's too early or if it's too late? You probably know it's too late, but how do you know if it's too early, you know? I could picture myself in that situation, you know, like things are going sour and then you're like, can I get myself out of this? When do I actually push and call for help? And I think it's also a good point that I think as a whole, we're definitely we're hesitant to ask for help. And I see that a lot. You know, I see a lot of people on the mountain that you can tell they need help, but, you know, I usually have to initiate it or ask them how they're doing.
That's interesting, because that's not the image that I think a lot of people have. I think a lot of people think about, you know, the person who, you know, gets a blister, Lieutenant Nealand, and says, help me, help me. So it's good to hear that there's another side to this. Go ahead, Lieutenant Nealand. What do you think?
I think the people that are equipped with the beacons, I think, are somewhat hesitant at times to push it when need be and trying to get themselves out of their own predicament. When it comes to the cell phones, I think they jump on them a little too early. So probably the people that have the locator devices are probably more serious mountaineers. The people just out for a day hike probably wouldn't have that device and then resort to the cell phone, because it's what they resort to when they're driving down the interstate and they see a broken down car, they call. When they see an accident in front of, they call. So they are quick to call 911 thinking that's something that's immediate and that can help me.
Go ahead, Ty.
Yeah, and I think it's important for people to know that it takes a long time to get rescue assets into the backcountry. This is not like an urban environment where an ambulance will be there within 5 to 10 minutes. It takes hours to get people there.
Yeah, and in fact, I think I've seen you quote Lieutenant Nealand as saying, you know, people say, you know, will you be here soon? And you say, how long did it take you to get up the mountain?
That's my standard line. It's going to take us the same, and then we have to drive there and get a plan together. So it's never quick.
Lots more to talk about, guys. But let's go to our listeners. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Heidi's in Lancaster. Hi, Heidi. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks a lot. It's great to hear your show this morning, and I'm a champion of our conservation officers up here in the North Country. And a hiker of our great trails up here. And I just wanted to remind everybody of the importance of having either our hike safe card on us when we're hiking or our fishing and hunting license. I know that if I ever have to be rescued by your team, I always have my license with me, and those elements are so important. And I always go nuts when I see our teams out there, and I'm in the office with those guys as a UNH cooperative extension person. So.
Well, Heidi,
I just wanted to remind people.
Yeah, and thank you so much. We should talk about Hike Safe real quick, Lieutenant Nealand. A lot of people might not know what that is.
Okay, so search and rescue with New Hampshire Fish and Game is funded by $1 or fee on every fishing and hunting license and $1 on every OHRV and boat registration. So I misspoke. It's not $1 on the licenses. It's just $1 on the ATVs, snowmobiles, boats. And then in 2015, we incorporated a Hike Safe card. It's entirely voluntary. And the first year in 2015, we sold 2,800 of those. And up to 2017, we're up to already 4,500 for the current year, which has generated about $115,000 for the Search and Rescue Fund. So it's being voluntary, it's been truly impressive to me, the people that are trying to support Search and Rescue in the state of New Hampshire.
Heidi, thanks a lot for the call. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. So, Corey, when these Hike Safe cards first came out, I thought, okay, it's voluntary. Who's really going to buy it? Have you ever rescued somebody and then they pulled out their Hike Safe card?
I personally have not seen that. I think the people that know about the Hike Safe tend to be more savvy in the mountains. I could be wrong about that, but... yeah, I think it's the people that need the rescue maybe have never heard of it, or they're up for the day, you know, or I have not seen that in the mountains yet.
Yeah, so 2,800 cards is what you told us, right?
2,800 in 2015, 4,500 currently for this year.
Okay, so pretty impressive. And have you ever rescued somebody who said, look, here's my card?
I think it's only been a couple of occasions since 2015 that we've rescued someone, and I would agree with Corey. I think it's a way for the serious hikers to just support search and rescue that probably will never need it, but just want to support what they see going on in their mountains.
You know, we talked a lot about technology, trackers, GPS. Lieutenant Nealon talked about cell phones. But in the foreword to your book, Ty, written by Caroline Alexander, she mentions another type of technology problem. She asks, does an iPod loaded with music distract you from situational awareness? You know, you're hiking, you're feeling good, you're listening to your favorite music. But are you noticing, it's getting dark, you know, or, oh, I haven't seen another hiker in a while. Maybe I'm on this trail by myself. I wonder what you think about Caroline's point.
I think she makes a really important point. And one of the reasons I started talking with people about situational awareness and risk in relation to Kate's accident was, you know, we have become really distracted, whether we're driving our car, walking a sidewalk, or hiking at 5,000 feet. And I just think that's an important thing to emphasize, because if you're summit driven, you know, or if you're absorbed in the beauty of the mountains, you may not always be paying attention to factors that are changing around you. So I'm really glad she included that.
Yeah, I hadn't even thought about that type of technological issue. And then she also says, does a welter of weather information and expected conditions create the illusion of control? And Corey, I'm going to ask you first on this, but anybody can jump in. I mean, we all know the weather can change in a heartbeat, especially in the whites, especially in the winter. So, yeah, why do we sort of trust all these cool maps and stuff on our phones, which tell us the front's not coming until 3, when, you know, we know it could come in 5 minutes?
Yeah, I think in today's society, you know, we're spoiled with that kind of information. You know, things are generally pretty accurate down in the lowlands, you know.
That's an important point, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's a much different world up there.
Yeah.
We are spoiled even on Mount Washington, because we have, you know, a world-class weather station right on the summit. We have snow rangers at the base of the ravines that we ski and climb. So we are spoiled there, and they are a lot of times very accurate with that. But it's totally anyone's guess when it comes down to it. Every time I go up there, I go to a checkpoint and I assess the situation and make a decision, go to the next checkpoint or landmark, assess the situation. So I kind of take all that with a grain of salt, and then, you know, make my own decisions as I go.
Yeah, and it's easy to geek out with all the weather maps, and, you know, there's so many apps you can use, and they have these cool, you know, colors coming in and stuff, but it really, it's a guess. It's a good guess, but it's still, you know, there's still a lot of information. I wonder what you think about this, Ty, because from what I understand from your book, Kate Matrosova, you know, spent a lot of time looking at the weather and what it was going to be that day, but you know, in the White Mountains, you just never know.
Yeah, she checked the weather the Saturday evening before her Sunday morning climb.
And she started real early, 5 a.m.
Yeah, and she did not. And so the forecast that was posted at 5:15 by the observatory, she was already on the trail by then. And it was updated, but it was pretty consistent with the forecast for the night before.
Okay, yeah. So checking the weather, but in the White Mountains, as we know, that only goes so far.
Yeah, I think there's no such thing as expected weather in the presidential range or the whites.
All right, lots more to talk about in just a moment after a short break, gentlemen. You can join us too, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back. The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, mountain rescues and a new book about one case in 2015 that generated lots of reflection, the fatal winter hike of Kate Matrosova in the presidential range. A new book describes her story and what lessons it shows for all of us about how even the most experienced hikers assess risk. The book also reminds us yet again of how deceptive the White Mountains can be when it comes to sudden weather, challenging conditions. Let's hear from you. Have you ever gotten into some difficult situations in the White Mountains, or have you been involved in a rescue there? Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Lieutenant Neyland, Corey Fitzgerald, Ty Gagne, let's go right back to our listeners. Rich joins us from Mount Washington. Hi, Rich. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, Laura. Hello. Can you hear me okay?
Sure can. Go ahead.
Awesome. I'm actually calling from right under Huntington Ravine. Hello to Corey. It's Rich and Marsha from Harvard Cabin. We're up on the mountain a little early doing some cabin maintenance, getting ready for another winter season. We spent the last 8 winters on Mount Washington. We've been involved with many, many rescues. One thing that I would like the lieutenant to comment on, if he can, is describe for us the volunteer involvement with many rescues that Fish and Game initiate. I think that's an important topic that we often look over. Fish and Game certainly plays a critical role, but many of these rescues are led and completed by volunteers from Mountain Rescue Service, APSAR, which I've been involved with, and things like that. So or organizations like that. So I was wondering if the lieutenant could comment on that. My other comment is I wasn't familiar with Ty's book or that it was even being written, and I'm a little hesitant to discover what the premise of the book is. We have so many of these sort of rescues happening every winter and all year round, but it seems like every decade there's one that kind of stands out and people really latch on to that. And I'm wondering if there was ever an autopsy or anything completed. I was on the mountain the day Kate passed. It was a brutal day. We were doing work just to stay warm. We were splitting wood for the next winter, and I couldn't keep my chainsaw's carburetor from freezing up. It was a really nasty day.
Wow.
We don't, did Kate have a heart attack? Was there another issue that happened? I just think that there's an element of disrespect if we keep talking about this not in the right light.
Okay. Rich, thank you so much. Yeah, go ahead.
Finally, for the last 8 winters, wanted to invite you, Laura, and Sam Evans Brown up to Mount Washington, to Harvard Cabin, to really get a good viewpoint on how actually conservative and responsible most people in the outdoors are. I feel like the local media, the national media, really only latch on to these terrible stories, and they miss the amazing things that happen right here in New Hampshire. It is a world-class mountain. It's a training ground. It's a proving ground. I've been to Denali, a 30-mile-an-hour wind day on Denali, you don't get out of your tent. On Mount Washington, a 30-mile-an-hour day is the day you run for the summit. These are proving grounds, and there's an amazing, amazing community in the backcountry here. And
well, Rich, I am so glad that you called. I'm going to put you on hold so our producer can take your information, okay? So I really appreciate it because there's a couple pieces that we should pick up on here. And first to you, Lieutenant Neyland, he's absolutely right. Fish and Game's resources are limited. Who are these amazing volunteers who just, run out in the middle of the night to rescue people?
Well, once again, they are amazing people. And search and rescue would not be successful in this state without them. There are many groups situated around the state, depending on region, that we would call in an instance. And he's absolutely right. To provide a carryout, we need 18 to 21 people or so for an injured hiker, and you might have 2 or 3 COs there, so we're not carrying the whole litter ourselves.
COs,
so
it would conservation officer.
Conservation
yeah, you
officer.
Can't give them
yep.
a piggyback
That's
down
right.
the mountain.
So we rely on the volunteers, and once again, we would not be successful without them. And I just, it amazes me. I call on the foulest weather days, the middle of the night, middle of a Patriots game, and they show up, and they take part. They don't complain. They're the most giving people I know, and I hope when I retire I can give back half as much as they give on a daily basis on these rescues. I just don't know if the phone rings in the middle of the night after I get done, if I can do what they do. They're truly remarkable people.
Well, that's you, Corey. So what does it take to do this work? And how hard is it to recruit people to do it, to be, on call at a moment's notice? You got to be super fit. You got to know the mountains really well.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just for a lot of us, it's just a way to give back. we make the same mistakes, and we have made the same mistakes in the past. We just got away with it, you know, which most people do. And I think we see a lot of these people in ourselves, and we could see ourselves getting in similar situations. So I like to think that, you know, I'm putting in my time, and if my time ever comes where I might need some help or a helping hand, somebody's there for me, you know.
Hoping for some karma there. Two quickie questions, and I want to go to you, Ty. So you said, you know, I see myself in some of these folks. I've made similar mistakes. I mean, what kind?
That's a good question. I mean, early in my career, I've definitely made some questionable decisions in the whites, you know. We didn't get to the point where a rescue was needed, but...
But you could have.
I could have, yeah. I mean... One more bad decision could have put me in the same situation.
Can you give me an example? Like you didn't take enough water or you didn't have good shoes or...
One example that comes to mind, my brother and I, very early on, were doing our first winter presidential traverse, which is a pretty big deal. It's pretty brutal up there in the winter. And we ended up getting onto a trail towards the end that had not been broken out. So made the horrible decision of instead of like backtracking to where we knew where we were, we tried to bushwhack to a different trail, and in the winter that's just not a good idea because the trail that we were on was not broken out, so we were up to our waist and our chest in snow,
really
crawling
wow.
on top of it. It was,
oh my gosh,
it was a mess. But long story short, we found a trail, we got out. But it got a little desperate there for a little while.
I also wonder, with the aging of New Hampshire, if it's harder to find volunteers for search and rescue, just because folks, you know, at some point you probably can't get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and hike up a mountain.
Yeah, and I think a big part of it, too, is, you know, a lot of the people that come to the White Mountains are coming up for a day. You know, they're coming from the cities. So we're working with a pretty limited population up there. And a lot of the volunteers... that I'm friends with, I know, live in southern New Hampshire. So, you know, they're a good 2-hour drive to the whites.
Mm.
So it is hard, I think, to get numbers. But seems like we're making it work.
Ty, go ahead.
Ironically, we had a board of directors meeting last night for the Androscoggin team, and that was one of the issues on the agenda was, you know, how do you maintain a robust roster given the changes that are taking place in the state, and also recognizing that people have lives beyond their volunteer work, but that the importance of having people show up to go out to calls to support fishing game and support, obviously, the distressed hiker.
Yeah. So what about the point that Rich made, Ty? Just concern that books like this, he didn't use this word, but sort of sensationalize these tragedies and make it seem like, you know, this stuff happens all the time and it's terrible.
Yeah, I really appreciate his candid question. I hope he's still listening. I'm glad he asked it. You know, the premise of the book really evolved out of the discussion I've been having for a couple of years with groups about decision making and risk in relation to Kate's story. And as you noted at the beginning of the show, you know, there was some controversy with this. But it also haunted people. I mean, the North Country in some ways is still rattled by this. And there are a lot of great mountaineering books out there, of which I love to read. And what I wanted to do with this was, yes, it was a tragedy, but what can we learn from it? And how can we relate Kate's story to ourselves?
Well, it's kind of what Corey said. You know, he sees in some of the folks he rescues some of the same mistakes he's made. He just happened to be luckier that day. Yeah. What rattled people about this so much? I mean, clearly it's always disturbing when a super fit, super experienced, you know, apparently wonderful person loses her life. But what rattled people especially?
Well, I think for those who are reflective, it raises the issue of your own vulnerability. So I think that got to people. But I also think that, you know, people in the North Country and across the state knew that the weather was coming in, that the system was arriving out of Canada, and it was no secret. And
as Rich said, he remembers that day. It was terrible.
Sure.
Go ahead.
And so you got to see this in real time. A lot of times when you hear a news story about a rescue, it's already taken place. It's over. The problem's been resolved. And in this case, it was ongoing, and you were experiencing this really extreme weather yourself, as you knew Fish and Game and volunteers were going into harm's way to try to save Kate.
I want to ask you about that harm's way comment in just a minute, but go ahead, Corey.
Yeah, I think part of this was very relatable to people, especially it caught the attention of the more experienced hikers and mountaineers because she was one of us.
You know? Again, I mean, as Ty said earlier, this is not somebody in a T-shirt and flip-flops.
Exactly, yeah. She was well-prepared and had experience. So I think it hit a nerve with some of us that, you know, have spent a lot of time in the mountains and kind of made us question, like, what would we have done differently? So I know from that population, it wasn't just the average rescue, you know, it wasn't the unprepared hiker, it was one of our own in some way.
You know, when there's a rescue, Lieutenant Nealon, do you need me to tell you this? The rescuers themselves are at risk. When you get these calls, do you ever find yourself, Lieutenant Nealon, you know, angry at the person for putting you and your team in this position, especially going out in really terrible weather? Or do you just not judge and you just go?
My judging usually is the next day or after the mission's completed. I try to just put that aside until we've successfully completed the mission and then do the gauging of what they did after the fact and determine if, you know, that's when we would determine if billing was required because of negligence and things like that. So we leave that for the next day.
How do you decide for the safety of your own team, we're calling it off?
Yeah, I leave that a lot of times to the people on the ground that are up there. And I think in this particular instance, there were a lot of phone calls before anyone ever hit the ground. And I think it's in Ty's book. My comments were, I'm not sure I would send anyone up into that environment. And that was when we had only one beacon hit at the time. And it was in an area that I myself didn't feel like we could get to safely, or anyone could get to safely. And then when we got other points below tree line that made it appear as though she might have been moving, then maybe we can reach her there. But as far as getting above tree line that day, we weren't probably going to do anything but hurt somebody else. And I likened it almost to a dive mission. As I was talking with Ty earlier, I'm on the dive team. And when we go to a dive mission, unfortunately, the victim is already deceased. It makes my decision a lot easier. There's no sense risking somebody else's life to go after that person until it's safe to do so. And that's almost what it was like in this instance. Very dangerous that day, and didn't want anyone going above and beyond their means.
You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. So, Ty, when Lieutenant Nealon said, you know, he has to decide, I maybe don't want to send anybody up in that condition. I mean, my stomach kind of dropped. It's such a hard decision to make. There's this one person who's clearly struggling, but then he's got 18 other lives to worry about. So I'd love your thoughts on how those risk assessment decisions are made, not just for the person who's lost or in trouble, but for the people who might do the rescuing.
Yeah, I think the first priority in these situations is the safety of the rescuers. And I think Fish and Game does a really good job, and the team leaders of the volunteer teams do a really good job at putting that first. And the book is as much about the decision making that was taking place on the night and next day of the rescue mission as it is about where Kate was, what she was doing, and what may have been influencing some of the decisions that she was making. So I tried to balance the two as much as I could.
What might have been influencing the decisions she was making, such as extreme cold, clouding your judgment? I mean, what are you talking about there?
Well, hypothermia certainly has an impact on your cognitive performance, for lack of a better term. But aside from that, one of the things I talk about in the book are biases and the things that can fuel or influence some of the decisions that we make, whether we're in the mountains or, again, we're at sea level.
Here's an email that came in from Gary in Sugar Hill. He says, I can see the White Mountains from my home in Sugar Hill. As you speak, they are completely socked in. An hour or so ago, they were clear. The weather can change quickly, and people who may have driven 2 or more hours to get there are reluctant to change their plans. This is a common problem, Gary says, in winter backcountry activity in avalanche-prone terrain when human factors can override their observations. They knowingly accept too much risk, usually because they've been there before in the same conditions and assume they will be okay. Gary says most avalanches that injure people are caused by their actions, and they are often experts in their sport, skating, ice climbing, skiing, etc. Gary says, I won't travel in avalanche country with anyone who isn't properly trained and equipped, but many people do. Wow, Gary, thank you so much for the email. And what do you think, Corey? I'm guessing you got some thoughts there.
Yeah, the first thing that comes to mind for me, especially when it comes to avalanche accidents, is it's often caused, not all the time, but I see a lot where people plan these trips, you know, they have 2 weeks off a year, so they're coming from afar. They planned it 3 months ago, and whether the snow is stable or whether the weather is good, it doesn't matter. This is their chance to do it. So they do assume more risk because this is their chance. You know, we see it on big mountains too, in the Himalayas and Denali, all this money and time invested. You got to make it happen.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, for anybody at this table, we can just say, all right, we'll come back another day. But if you're from New York City, you took a week off, you want to do it. You're here.
Exactly. I think that's overlooked, you know. Living in the White Mountains, I pretty much just pick my days, you know, pick the best days and go for it. But I take bigger trips across the country and across the world, too. And, you know, you feel that, especially when you have people paying you to take you there. There's a lot of pressure there to perform and be successful, but that's basically why they're hiring me, is to make those tough calls.
Right. And from what I understand, you were leading a group the day that Kate Matrosova was also out experiencing difficulty?
That's right. Yeah, we were heading up Mount Washington that day. And in the morning, I knew the forecast was going to be horrendous. So I just printed out the forecast for my clients, which I rarely do, just point blank read it to them, and I told them, if we get above tree line today, Lionhead, it's maybe half hour above tree line, and if we get there, that's going to be a monumental effort, and that will be our summit. I don't think I've ever said that to anybody before. You know, usually it's, we're going to try to make the summit. It's always a possibility, but that day I just said, there's no way. And we did make it to Lionhead, but it was right on the edge there. Yep.
When you say right on the edge, what do you mean?
I felt like, you know, if it was any worse, it probably would have been a bad decision to go to Lionhead. Yeah. But we were right on the margin. I had very strong climbers with me. And we did it. I think we did it within our means. But,
you know, I'm struck by this because Ty, he was in a group, and these group of people had a leader, Corey. Kate was alone.
She was. And, when I sat down and talked with Corey, and also Eric Thatcher, who was guiding clients up the opposite side of Mount Washington that Sunday. I was struck by the candor and the clear expectations that they communicated to their paying clients prior to even leaving the parking lot and starting up the trail. And I think that was critically important and a good lesson for everybody.
Okay. We will talk more in just a moment. Lots more to talk about and some more emails and phone calls. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, mountain rescues and one particular rescue and what it might teach us, the fatal winter hike of Kate Matrosova in the presidentials. A new book tells what happened to this very experienced, very fit hiker, and reminds us of how we all assess risk and make decisions, sometimes not very well. Join us with your questions and comments, your own personal stories, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. With me in the studio, Corey Fitzgerald, co-owner of Northeast Mountaineering. Also, Lieutenant James Nealand, he leads New Hampshire Fish and Game's Advanced Search and Rescue Team. And Ty Gagne, certified wilderness first responder, a member of the Androscoggin Valley Search and Rescue Team, and also author of the book that we've been looking at, Where You'll Find Me, Risk Decisions in the Last Climb of Kate Matrosova. And all of you, let's go right back to our listeners. And Nancy is on the line from Franconia. Hi, Nancy. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I've been hiking in the White Mountains for 30 years now, and when I get out there, sometimes I see people and I just cringe because they're so ill prepared. And I have friends on the rescue squads and know that they do risk their lives to go out and save people. So I was very pleased to see now at some of the bases of the bigger trails, especially in Franconia Notch, that there are the volunteer advisors talking to people before they head up there. And I think that that will make a big difference. And I just want to congratulate whoever it was that came up with that idea and thank those people for contributing their time to make our mountain safe for everybody.
What makes you cringe, Nancy?
When you see people out in their Tevas heading up Falling Waters Trail with a Budweiser in their hand, or, you know, going up Bridal Path with their kid on their shoulders wearing, you know, Keds.
Yeah.
You know, and no, you see kids out there with no, the parents don't have a backpack. The kids don't, you know, they have a T-shirt on. They have no sweat. There's no warm clothes. There's no rainy clothes. I always say to my friends when I introduce them to hiking, you know, you always want to bring enough clothes that if you have to sit there for 5 hours because you broke your ankle, and it's going to take that long for someone to come get you, that you don't freeze to death in the interim. And that can happen if you're in shock at, you know, 50 degrees. So that's sort of the why people say, why do you have so many clothes with you? It's 75 degrees out. I'm like, because if I have to sit there for 5 hours, it's going to get dark. It's going to get cold. So
Nancy, I'm so glad you called. Yeah, and Lieutenant Nealon wants to jump in. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to comment to the program that she was talking about.
Yeah, I hadn't heard about that. I've heard about Hike Safe, but go ahead.
John Marinowski with the U.S. Forest Service a couple of years back started a program. It's called the Trail Steward Program. They monitor 6 trailheads around the Whites that they've designated, you know, as high activity areas where they will encounter hikers as they take to the trail, trying to educate them, kind of looking them over, I think, as they approach the trail, determining whether they look like they're able to complete such a hike or at least update them on the weather conditions. And they obviously man the Falling Waters trailhead like she was talking about. That's probably my most heavily call area is that trailhead, and I've seen my calls drop significantly since this program was instituted.
Really? Just talking to people, what you got in that pack? Do you think you have enough?
I've watched from a distance. I've hung back and watched, and I can see what I consider to be 3 or 4 ill-equipped hikers going across the parking lot. They will approach them nicely, and a lot of times I see them walking away probably to another destination that's probably easier and more suits their abilities. So,
and their footwear.
And their footwear. That's usually how I gauge it, whether it's flip-flops and so on. You can tell they're not able for the 9-mile hike to complete that. But it's really been a tremendous success. They extended their hours into the afternoon hours, and I really think they're getting hold of the people that are leaving too late in the day, getting caught without lights and just the light of their cell phone, basically.
So maybe I had not heard about this program, Nancy, so thank you. Maybe the next step is to, you can make a little money on this, like to sell some of this stuff, right? I mean,
I suppose
lights and the granola bars.
And the state park would have just an idea. That, I'm sure.
Well, and this reminds me of an email from Jennifer and Lee, kind of relates to what you and Nancy were talking about, Lieutenant Nealon. Could your guests please tell us what they wish every hiker wore and what they should have packed? So, Corey, that's for you.
Yeah, that's a tough one. It's hard to say because there's so many different philosophies out there. You got the light and fast folks, and you got the heavy and slow folks. Obviously, the heavy and slow folks are going to be more prepared. They're going to be ready for an unexpected night out, maybe 2 nights out. So they're obviously walking the safer line. Their margin of error is much greater. But there's a lot of people, a lot of my friends, myself included, sometimes like to go light and fast. And, you know, in the summer, we have a small trail running pack, and that's about it. You know, we're not prepared for the night out. And there's certain satisfactions that come with that, you know, being alone and a light and fast pack. But I think the difference there is just knowing what your level of acceptable risk is. If I go out with a light pack and no supplies, I know what I'm getting into, and I've accepted that risk. So it's hard to tell people you can't do this or you can't do that or you should do this. It's all about their level of acceptable risk and their education.
Go ahead, Ty.
Yeah, I think before you decide what you put in your pack or on your body for warmth or thermoregulation, I think you have to know yourself. I think you have to be realistic about your goals, what your technical competency is, what drives you. And I think you have to be able to manage those things before I think you even show up at the trailhead, because typically it's, while hypothermia and thermoregulation issues cause problems, it's the decisions that are made amidst a hike or a climb that I think lead to most problems.
This does come up in your book, though, right, Ty? This sort of idea of light and fast and heavy and slow. And Monday morning quarterbacking is, you know, tricky, mm-hmm. Especially when someone has died, of course. But some people did say, how come she didn't have a sleeping bag?
I think it was a personal decision. She felt she was going to move with enough speed across that ridge line that she was going to stay warm, that she was going to outrun the incoming weather. And as I mentioned in the book, you know, that's a thin margin for error.
Go ahead, Corey.
Yeah. I think especially in bigger mountains, speed is safety. Mm-hmm. So if you're always carrying the 60-pound pack, that's more time you're spending out there in the hazard. So, you know, it is great to be fully prepared, but also be prepared in the lightest way possible.
Mm. Yeah. Maybe that's the compromise. Is there a list, Lieutenant Neyland, to answer Jennifer's question, you know, every time you go for a major hike in the White Spring, X, Y, and Z?
Yeah, for Jennifer or any new hiker out there, any hiker that's been hiking for a while, if they just want to visit hikesafe.com, there's a long list of equipment, the 10 essentials that I kind of require that they have on all-day hikes, at least, at a minimum. And then there's a long list of other equipment, depending on the weather and terrain, that they could add to their pack. So that list is very helpful. Just a little checklist to go through every time and make sure that's in your pack. If you grabbed your headlamp because you needed to change a flat tire and didn't put it back in your pack, it's a good thing to go through that before you head out on every thing, checking your batteries and all that kind of stuff. So there's some good reminders in that hikesafe.com.
Okay, so Jennifer, there you have it. And guys, before we go back to our listeners, I did want to ask you this, Corey, and maybe you too, Ty. The dangers of Monday morning quarterbacking, especially when someone, you know, has lost their life.
Yeah, we saw this a lot with this specific case. It got a lot of notoriety in the media and, you know, the Facebook forums and all of these things were so connected digitally. So, you know, it gets posted somewhere and all of a sudden you're just reading endless comments and a lot of them are negative.
Yeah, some of them not very kind.
Yeah, I mean, there were plenty of positive ones as well, which was nice to see. But it's so easy to Monday morning quarterback these things. I would have done this, I would have done that. And I think ultimately, what it comes down to is it's just people justifying to themselves that it couldn't happen to them. Where, and then on the flip side, a lot of us, it opened our eyes, you know, to, wow, this could happen. And I know I've changed things about how I go about the mountains. Just after joining search and rescue and seeing these cases, it's changed my outlook on it for sure.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. Ty, I'd love your thoughts, too, on the sort of pitfalls of Monday morning quarterbacking, especially in a very sad case like the one that you wrote about.
Yeah, I think Corey makes excellent points about why we react the way we do. As I mentioned earlier, I think emotions were across the board on this particular accident. I personally have a lot of empathy for Kate and for Charlie and her family.
Charlie was her husband.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. And we all make decisions that can lead to negative outcomes. We cannot lose sight of that. And that's the tone I really tried to strike in the book and when I talk with people about her.
Let's take another call, all of you. And this is Thomas in Concord. Bringing Thomas on the air. No, let's bring Rob. How about Rick in New London? I apologize. Rick in New London is on the air. Go ahead, Rick. Rick, you on the air with us? Okay. Let's try Rob in Nashua. Hi, Rob. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Morning. Go ahead, Rob.
Thank you. When answering the question of what's the appropriate gear to wear, one of your guests delved into the topic of personal decisions of what's acceptable risk or not. And I just wanted to offer the insight that as time goes on and hiking becomes more of a specialized activity and people who are passionate about it get more gear intensive, what the community decides is acceptable risk has gone down and down and down. You know, back when people started skiing Tuckerman's Ravine, they were doing it in wool sweaters. So I would just like to wonder, get the guest's opinion or statements on what determines the, or what allows them, or where do they make the call for Monday morning quarterbacking? You know, there was a guy who ran the Boston Marathon in a loincloth and bare feet, 26 miles this year. He's physically capable of doing such a thing. So what determines how much tech gear and how much Gore-Tex someone has to wear before they get fined for doing something that a third party deems was too risky?
Wow. Okay. So that's a big question, Rob. Thank you so much. Yeah. Go ahead, Lieutenant Nealand.
Well, there really are no fines for not having a headlamp or not having the appropriate gear. What it comes down to is there are a list of what we feel are essential items that one should take on a hike that would allow them to get themselves in and out of their own predicament without the need of assistance. And once we get called in, the way it works is in our search and rescue report, the Attorney General reviews the case and determines if what they deem there was any negligence or not. And then the person is potentially billed for the cost of the rescue, which happens very infrequently, really, when it comes down to it. So,
okay. But Rob kind of asks a fundamental question, and you're saying it's hard to assess that. But usually it sounds like you don't assess somebody as negligent.
Well, I mean, if someone left at 6 in the afternoon and the sun was going to set at 6:30 and they left over a 9-mile hike without a headlamp, I consider that negligence. And then when you call because the sun actually set, which it does every day of the year and hopefully continues to do so, then you need to have a light after dark. So.
All right. Well, all of you, there's a lot more we could have talked about. Ty Gagne, thank you, and congratulations on the book. I really appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Laura.
Ty Gagne, certified wilderness first responder, author of the book Where You'll Find Me, Risk Decisions and the Last Climb of Kate Matrosova. Lieutenant Nealand, good to have you. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Lieutenant James Nealand from Fish and Game, and Corey Fitzgerald, thank you also for taking the time and making the trip.
Thank you for having me.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.